All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Stark After Dark. I'm your host, Jordan Clark. And on this episode, I am joined by the one and only Meg Downey.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, great to have you on. Tell everybody a little bit, if they don't know who you are, about who you are and what you
do. My name is Meg Downey. I am a full-time comic book journalist. I freelance for DC, for Polygon, for IGN, for GameSpot, for a whole bunch of different websites. I specialize in kind of the historical context and also like the fan context of superheroes and kind of comic history. That's, you know, like I explain things, but I try to not be too inapproachable or dense about what I'm talking about. My interests are really in getting people who think that they either don't have, you know, like the time or the energy to get into comics, or, you know, have felt kind of alienated from comics. Like, those are the people I want to reach predominantly. So that's me.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like comics now, you know, with the proliferation of movies and television and all kinds of other mediums, you know, when I go to comic book shops, I always like to talk to the people who run them, because I feel like, you know, the thing that is probably happening more often now is people are kind of coming in and they're like, you know, I saw Black Panther, or I watched Arrow, or, you know, you know, I'm into, you know, Riverdale. Like, what is, is there a comic I can read that goes with that? Like, what can I get into? And you know, I feel like there's a lot of people who are definitely open to the prospect of comics, but the actually getting into it and finding those starting points of what is going to get you hooked, I think that's the challenge that people and retailers are having now, just in terms of figuring out how to cross-pollinate that interest to make sure that everybody's kind of getting what they want.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's one of those things where you really have to find how to tap the vein and how to tap it in a way that's sustainable, because, you know, like there's always going to be the kind of boom in interest that happens after, you know, like a big movie or a TV show or whatever. But that's why I think, I mean, like, finding ways to get people hooked on character relationships is one of like the big sustainable ways, because you can, I think, you know, when you deal with comics or when you deal with superheroes, there's always that sort of like knee-jerk intimidation factor where it's like, oh, well, the stories and like the history and the content is just so dense and it's so complicated and there's so much. But if you can be like, well, no, don't focus on the fact that, you know, like, okay, well, it's about the Infinity Stones and, you know, the world's ending and there's, you know, people, teams coming in and out and you're like, oh, this guy died and they come back. Like, whatever, don't worry about any of that. Worry about the fact that, like, okay, you have one or two characters that you've really connected with. Like, these two characters are like these three characters that you just love. Focus on them. Find the thread that you can follow, you know, if it's about their romance, if it's about, you know, like their existential drama, whatever. That's how you get people to stay. You know, like, that's how you get people to last for longer than just like that, you know, month and a half immediately after the big, you know, movie release or the big TV premiere or whatever. Yeah, which is why I think, I don't know, I just think that if you're trying to sell new people on getting into comics, the quickest and easiest way to do it is to be like, okay, I mean, I know that shipping is kind of a colloquialism that's not necessarily respected anymore, but I mean, if you can sell people on a ship, be it, you know, fan-based or, you know, canonical or whatever, that's your way in. That's how you do it. But unfortunately it's still a little, I mean, we're getting there, we're making progress. But it's still a little, you know, frowned upon, I think, especially in some comic shops. Cause that's not how you used to have to do it, but, you know, times change, things change.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, comic books are in some ways billed as these kind of soap operas, and if I had to sit down and explain the X-Men to somebody, like, I don't know where I would even begin. But you know, if you were to just sit somebody down and have them watch a few episodes of like General Hospital, like, they'd probably be like, well, I like those people and I want to see more of that. And so you know, if you have even within the X-Men, if it's just like, hey, you know, I like Jean Grey and Cyclops, or I like you know, Rogue and Gambit, or I like, right. you know, this other couple. It's like, well, at least I have this that yeah. I can kind of latch onto, and then that's how I can kind of find my way into everything else.
Right. And I mean, I think there's sort of like this, there's a universality, right, to like romance, no matter what it is. Like, it's kind of not even, you know, it's not even just confined to superheroes. It's just any genre. Like, the reason that we gravitate to, you know, sci-fi and fantasy and whatever is because, you know, like, there's a shorthand that can happen with those character relationships that makes it really easy to, you know, like, be like, okay, I don't care that this guy, you know, like, okay, so he's got powers to make kinetic energy, like, what, like, he throws cards and he's Cajun, but he's, you know, like, whatever, like, that's all garnish, like, that's right. all fine. It's the fact that, like, you want to root for these people to, you know, to be together. I'm not, you know, like, in my day-to-day life, I don't, like, really consider myself a romantic person, but when I'm, like, consuming fiction or whatever, like, that's where you go, that's what you want, is
right.
to be able to kind of root for, you know, these two people to either end up together or not end up together, or you know, find their way. I think that that's just a beautiful, fun, and interesting thing that, you know, is one of the most sustainable things about comics, which, I don't know, I would wish, I hope, my hope beyond hope, and it's changing, it's getting better, is, you know, that sometime down the line, you know, we'll stop looking at, like, oh, well, you know, like, shipping is just, like, it's garnish, and, like, it's, oh, it's these fangirls, no, it's these Tumblr teens, mm-hmm. who, you know, like, that's not true, like, it's just fun, it's a fun way to engage and interact with, you know, the medium that you like, and it's, you know, it's a conversation, it's not just, like, a, you're not listening to a speech, you're having a dialogue, which I yeah. think is, you know, I think that that's fun and important, and kind of the key to making these things last forever.
Right. Well, we're gonna talk a little bit about romance comics and shipping.
Yeah.
We're gonna do some shipping ourselves yes. in a little bit. but I always start off with every guest asking them two questions. Mm-hmm. The first of which is, what is your favorite comic book romance, if you have one?
I mean, my kind of ultimate favorite romance, that isn't necessarily canon. I'm a big Stucky fan, like Bucky Barnes and Steve Rogers. Prior to that, I used to be growing up. And so, like, I will 100% admit, I'm not going to be that person who's like, oh, I liked it before it was popular. No, that is 100% born of the MCU and being like that reinvention of those characters. And I was like, yay. But prior to that, when I was, you know, kind of a up and coming comic book fan in like high school, my big draw was Stoney, or Steve Rogers and Tony Stark. Yeah, I still love, like, they still have like a very near and dear place in my heart.
Right.
Those are, you know, like, that's kind of like my number one, like, I guess, like, in the text, I don't know if it's necessarily romantic all the time, but like in the text relationship that I like followed, that really was kind of responsible for me getting, you know, at least potentially partially hooked. And then on the DC side, I always really, really liked the relationship between the Robins, which isn't, again, necessarily romantic, but the sort of like platonic found family aspect between right. Like the Bat family is just great to me, which is like, it can be romantic sometimes. Like, I'm a big fan of like Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon. I think that I go back and forth between whether or not I like them or like them together or not. But that was a big foundational thing for me too.
So going to the other side, do you have any, do you have a least favorite comic book?
Oh.
A couple that you're just kind of like, I can't.
I used to be, like in kind of like the fandom community and like the shipping fandom community, we have OTPs and no TPs, which are exactly what they right. sound like. So you have, you know, like your no TPs or the characters that you hate. I used to be a person who considered myself very much like, I had my ships that I really, really liked, and then I had the ships that I was like, oh, I hate them. But as I've grown up, I have kind of just like it's all cool. Like, it's fine. Like, I'm good with all of it. I will say, you know, like this is gonna make me sound a bit like a jerk because I just said I liked Stucky and Starnie so much, but I'm not a big fan of Steve and Sharon Carter as a romance in the comics and in the I think Sharon Carter is an amazing character. I think they kind of did her dirty in the MCU and they've kind of been suffering for that on the comic side. Like they don't necessarily know what to do with her. She's been aged up in the comics for a while now and it's a little weird. I mean, Steve's been going through his own weirdness, you know, for the last couple of years. So there's just not a lot of chemistry there. And if you go back and read the old, you know, like 70s and 80s Cap comics, the Steve, Peggy, Sharon dynamic is buck wild. It's awful. It's so bad. It's like that's kind of soured me on that whole like dynamic. But I mean, whatever. Like I'm still chill with it. Like it's fine. But I think that's the closest thing I've got to like a ship that makes me like, no, thank you.
It can be a little weird. I mean, again, there's a lot of in comics you do get a lot of just weird either time displaced or like. Clone or kind of strange.
Oh my god!
It's like I don't know if this is okay because
it's like the Steve, Peggy, Sharon thing back in like the 70s. Oh my god, it was so bad. It was so bad. I mean, because this is like the end of the Silver Age, you know, kind of dawn of the Bronze Age in comics, and it's you know, it's got the comics code going on. So like relationships have to be, you know, very, very much set one way or another. It's kind of starting to take a little bit more of the like dramatized dark turn of like the 70s and 80s. But like Steve and Peggy and Sharon, after Steve came back, you know, kind of in the late 60s, you know, like the original Steve Rogers is back. He's, you know, the origin story that we all know is, you know, he got unthawed from the ice, blah, blah, blah. Peggy and Sharon were both dating Steve.
Yeah.
But Peggy had amnesia and didn't know. Oh, that was the other thing. This is the other big component is that for a very, very long time until actually 2001, Steve Rogers had a secret identity in the Marvel universe. And so like people didn't know that Steve Rogers was Captain America. And so the long and the short of the Steve Rogers, Sharon Carter, Peggy Carter relationship in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s was that Sharon was dating Steve and knew Steve was Cap. Peggy was dating Cap and didn't know that Cap was Steve.
Yep.
And so it was just like, and she was, it was wild. And Steve was a total jerk about it too. He was the worst. And he's written, you know, like very much like, oh, I'm the big strong man. And these, you know, like fainting women can't handle the truth and it would just break their hearts and blah, blah, blah. And then like, oh, it was so bad. And then Sharon had to like die to get her out of the way. It was very bad. It was so bad. So I think that's, you know, that's the one that I'm like, no, thank you.
I don't know. Between that one and Cyclops, Madeline Pryor, Jean Grey. It's just,
it's very much. Oh,
not great.
Not great.
Well, so what I want to do to start is I want to pick your brain a little bit since I have you here. You are a comics historian, and one of the things that is very interesting to track in terms of the progression of comics as an industry and as a market is that in the initial boom of comics, one, you know, superheroes were kind of a thing, but there were so many other forms of comics between westerns, war comics, and of course romance comics, which were a huge part of the industry. And as time kind of went on, you know, whether or not it may be directly, you know, linked to A, the rise in superhero comics, and B, the comics code itself, you know, they kind of started to take more and more of a back seat to the point where there came a time where there weren't any real romance comics on the, on the stands anymore. And, you know, in recent years, obviously, you know, with things like Rosie Press doing their romance stuff with, you know, Alex DeCampi and stuff like Twisted Romance. And then, you know, even seeing Marvel and DC over the last couple of years having, you know, Valentine's Day specials and things like that. You know, romance comics specifically, you know, comics billed as romance comics, not just comics with romance in them. kind of making somewhat of a comeback. And then obviously with the boom of web comics,
right,
it's more and more prevalent where you can just go online and find that. So talk to us a little bit about what made romance comics so popular back in the day, and why or why not they might seem to be making a little bit of a comeback today.
Sure. I mean, I think when you think about comics kind of like as we understand them now, like you have to understand that like back in the 40s, comics just in general were not, I mean, they were not the sort of like glorified art form that we consider them today. They weren't like a specialized art form. They were like lowbrow art. They were art for people who, you know, like were dirt poor from the Depression, like had no, probably couldn't read all that well. Like the idea that like, oh, they're, you know, like it's pictures predominantly, and like you can kind of understand the story. It's for immigrants who don't speak a lot of English. It's for people who otherwise, you know, could not afford to buy novels. So there was this sort of very utilitarian, like, these are for everyone, they're going to appeal to everybody. And so, like, the idea that, like, superheroes were kind of inherently propagandistic, not necessarily, like, from the start, but, like, there was very much, there's a huge link between, you know, like, superheroes and sort of, like, the rise of World War II and, and everything, and kind of respond to that. But, like, the other genres of comics are really just escapism, you know, like, it was, you know, your daily stories. This is, you know, if your family doesn't have a radio to listen to radio shows, you know, like obviously TV is not a thing at this time. You know, like you probably don't want to, if you're, you know, like if you're a first generation Italian immigrant and you can't speak all that English, newspapers are not going to do much for you. Like blocks of like walls of text of English, not helping. So comics, just in general, are, you know, for people young and old to have some sort of entertainment. And so, of course, romance comics and just kind of comedy strips and this sort of like day-to-day slice of life stuff is hugely, hugely popular with everybody. Like there's, I don't have the statistics like right off of the top of my head or anything, but, you know, like we associate comics as being the sort of like male-dominated field, but like that is not true at all in like the 40s and 50s. Like it was at least a completely even split. It might have been more, you know, predominantly female markets, you know, for a while there too. But then of course the comics code happens. The comics code is a, you know, moral scare that makes it seem like, you know, like, oh, these immoral, you know, terrible books, you know, it's the same thing that happened, you know, with Elvis and rock and roll, or, you know, any pop culture that happens that becomes kind of popular with, you know, the quote unquote lower brow communities, immediately becomes this big moral panic for anyone who's, you know, not part of those communities, because like, oh Lord, we don't want any, the poor people are going to rise up because they're cultured now, and whatever.
The youth are going to be infected by.
Yes, exactly. Like, so the Comics Code Authority, you know, happened in the 50s and really quashed that, sort of those multiple genres, because the accessibility was scary. The idea that like horror and violence and romance and the sort of like non-puritanical, you know, expression was happening. That really quashed those genres almost, you know, almost completely. It basically killed them. Not because people didn't want them, but because the CCA basically said that like, you can't show X, Y, and Z. Like you cannot have these things that happen, which actually that hurt the superhero genre as well. It hurt everything. And
it
so
Silver Age though, which
exactly, which, you know, like the Silver Age is the Silver Age because there was so many, like you can't show like, gun violence. You can't show horror moments. You can't show peril, whatever peril means. Like you can't show all of these things. And so they, like when you say, all right, like you want to have a romance comic, but you can't show people kissing, you can't show people holding hands, you can't show, you know, like anything that could potentially be read as like deviance or like, you know, like whatever, you just can't do it. You paint yourself in a corner, those books die out. And that's where you get the Silver Age. That's where you get the sort of like, you know, misassumption that comics have always been for boys and that, you know, like blah, 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 because, you know, they started making comics that really only appealed to, you know, 14-year-old boys in, you know, like the 60s. However, in the modern era, you know, like the downfall of the CCA, I think really starting kind of in the Bronze Age, which is when the CCA started, like, you know, loosening its hands on, you know, like, its chokehold, and mm-hmm. the idea that, like, you could make comics that are socially relevant again, and not just, you know, kind of inadvertently socially relevant, but, like, extremely pointedly socially relevant, that started kind of bringing those audiences back. Then, you know, not necessarily quickly, and not necessarily intentionally, I don't think, because that's, you know, like, you pretty much weeded out anybody who was going to, you know, have a say in whether or not, you know, romance was going to come back or blah, blah, blah. So you have a bunch of dudes who are wanting to, you know, make their big political commentaries, and they're all, you know, white straight men who are going to stand up and say, you know, like, oh, well, this is bad and this is bad, and, you know, this is, you know, we're going to punch in the face or whatever. But, like, still, the idea that you could do that now was going to happen in, you know, like, the Bronze Age. And so that paves the way for, you know, 20, 30 years later, for people to come up and say, hey, wait a minute, like, we can just keep going. Like, we don't have to just, like, stay in that spiral of weird 90s extremism, or, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of, like, you know, it all has to be, you know, these big politically charged narratives, you know, like, one way or the other. Like, we can actually just kind of go back to having that slice of life. Like, we can mm-hmm. actually just have stories that are stories. Like, we can just have, you know, like, we can make those things come back in a way that is actually, you know, accessible to people who probably felt alienated for the majority of their life from comics because of, you know, the seeds that were sown in, you know, the CCA in the 50s and whatnot. And also, you know, like you said, the rise of web comics, self-publishing, there are no rules. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're posting your own comics on the internet, like, no one is going to come in and be like, nope, you can't do that. So it's such a hugely important thing as far as just, like, the evolution, and not even necessarily evolution, like, the reclamation of the genre and of, you know, the medium itself is concerned.
And it's interesting because, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about what's the biggest difference between American comics specifically and manga, because mm-hmm. manga in that period that you're speaking about, where comics kind of became such a boy dominated field, manga opened it up.
And
when you look at manga, you know, back then and today still, you know, they have sports comics, they have romance comics, they have you know, all kinds of different genres within the main manga field. So, like, if you like anything, there's probably a manga related to it. You know, whether it's sports or music or, you know, even just, you know, school relationships and stuff like that, like, it's mm-hmm. it's all out there. And so while comics kind of made a turn to ignore that kind of stuff, you know, other fields within comics, manga and European comics, kind of picked that up, and then all the people that were kind of ignored in the world of mainstream American comics kind of gravitated to these other places. So now you see a lot of creators, but also fans, you know, who grew up in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, like, they're all about manga. Like, they can tell you more about all these other mangas than they can tell you anything about X-Men or, you know, Batman or anything, because they weren't reading that because it wasn't marketed towards them.
But
all these other, you know, mangas and things like that, Sailor Moon, Dragon Ball Z, you know, now more modern stuff like, you know, Attack on Titan, and even you know, everything that's, you know, a lot of these animes are mangas first, or vice versa, get turned into them. So now, you know, there's that cross pollination that we don't really have with our there's not a lot of, like, independently created, like, animation that gets turned into comics after the fact. So it is interesting to kind of see, even again within web comics and stuff like that, the influence that manga and anime has had on those creators, and how, you know, were kind of emboldened to take up a lot of the things that you were talking about, because this was something that was speaking to them, so they can do that. But when you look at, you know, again, specifically 80s and 90s comics, like, it was not something that was not even just welcoming to all kinds of people, but like there was a very specific aesthetic that was happening.
Right.
If that aesthetic was not being met, you weren't making comics.
Right, exactly. And I think, I mean, this is me being just kind of a history nerd outside of liking comics history or whatever, but like you can really trace the kind of the evolution of all pop culture just kind of globally on, you know, its relationship to global crisis, mm-hmm. and specifically with war. And you can really, really see it, especially in the Cold War and the uprising of the Comics Code. And there's this paranoia and everything that's happening, which of course, you know, places like Europe and Japan were involved in the Cold War and had, you know, like a stake in the Cold War as well, mm-hmm. but it was not anywhere near what we were having. Like it was not, because, you know, we left World War II and had this sort of like, well, we're the good guys, like sort of chip on our shoulder about it. And of course with, you know, proclaiming yourself the good guy, there comes a tremendous amount of pressure to then be the good guy. Mm-hmm. And well, what does that mean? You know, like, what does that mean for anyone else? What does that mean for, you know, like global politics? What does that mean for other cultures? And there was just zero concern for that.
Yeah.
With, you know, within the US. And so, whereas, you know, like you can see that in our pop culture. You can absolutely see that in, you know, not even just in comics, but just across the board in pop culture, there's this sort of like tremendous, the Puritanism of American pop culture is so directly influenced by that sort of like, well, we did it and we're never gonna lose, you know, like sort of like bullshit attitude. Whereas like Japan did not have that. Japan had a different national trauma, and that their national trauma was so horrific and so, you know, like brutal that the art that came after, you know, the 40s in Japan basically like hopscotched that whole Puritanism, that whole like, oh, well, we're great and we're gonna, you know, make a bunch of things that prove how great we are. And it started just becoming this sort of like healing aspect. Like if you look at like any sort of like the White Lion and like the early like Tezuka stuff, it's got this like sort of like ennui to it, and it's got this sort of like existentialism and this sort of self-reflection that I think that we, you know, in American and American pop culture, there was just zero interest in self-reflection, because as far as we were concerned, it was like, well, we did it. We beat the bad guys. Why do we need to think about why we did, you know, like,
right.
And that, because they were able to sort of like skirt around that, you know, that sort of like need to promote themselves and like need to like pat themselves on the back and, you know, kind of bolster this sort of newfound nationalism, and instead kind of step back and look and say like, okay, how do we heal? Like, mm-hmm. how do we move forward? That then opened the door for all kinds, because there was no one really saying, well, this is the right way to heal. And right. this is the right way to, you know, proceed forward here. Like there was no right way. Whereas here there was specifically a right way, and that right way was going to be enforced by law. Damn it. Like that was how it was. It's just very interesting. It's a really weird and complicated time.
Well, shifting from geopolitical conflicts into into something that we were talking about a little bit before we came on air, and that's that is shipping.
Yes.
And, you know, with the rise of, you know, social media, Twitter, Tumblr, etc., and these fandoms popping up around basically anything that you can think of.
Yep.
You know, the shipping has become such a prominent part of a lot of pop culture things. But as you were saying, it is kind of looked at from the outside looking in as a dirty word and concept.
Yeah.
And for me, I, you know, it's not, it's basically a harmless act in that these people are, you know, putting together, whether or not it's you know, straight couples or queer couples or just platonic people they want to hang out. You know, there definitely is something that I can understand from the standpoint of when you look at a lot of media and pop culture, better today, but definitely, you know, way back in the day, if you were, you know, queer identifying, or if you were even, for me, looking at, you know, a lot of the X-Men as a black person, like they had black people, but
right.
Like I was kind of like, I guess I like Nightcrawler. He's blue, and
he's coded as, you know, like as something other than white, I guess. Like, yeah.
You know, watching Doug, I'm like, Skeeter's blue, so I guess you know he's my favorite. Again, due to stuff like the comics code, there was a lot of things that were going on that you could look at people and say, right. Well, I think this is what's happening or what is being, right. You know, alluded to famously X-Men wise,
yeah.
Mystique and Destiny mm-hmm. for a long time were living together yeah. and, you know,
like Kitty and Magic
together. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, I don't know what you're trying to tell me, but I'm going to make the assumption here,
right.
know, that this is what's happening. And right. you know, when you don't see yourself presented to yourself in media, you're kind of left with the option of creating yourself somewhere within these worlds that you're a fan of.
Right.
And, you know, for shipping, that's what I see a lot of what's happening. Even with people like, you know, when you bring up Stucky, a lot of people are like, well, why would you want to, you know, ruin that relationship by making them, you know, whatever. And I'm like,
yeah.
Well, it's who does that hurt?
If, right.
if that happens, like that doesn't change the way I view Captain America or Bucky. Like,
right.
You know, so if you want to go down that road and look at it that way, that's perfectly fine. If you
right.
don't and you want to read it as it's always been written, that's also fine.
Right.
But again, it's the idea of the status quo being challenged that I think makes a lot of people uncomfortable in terms of,
yeah.
you know, the way that a lot of shipping is presented. So talk to us a little bit about your journey into shipping and kind of how you see its place within comics.
Yeah. I think the most important thing about shipping and the reason that I want so badly for it to be taken more seriously is because I think it's probably the number one biggest gateway for people who aren't straight white guys to get into superhero comics. Like shipping in general is just there. I have this sort of like soapbox that I like to pull out every so often, especially about Batman comics, is because, you know, like when you're trying to find, like, say, you know, like you're a 15-year-old girl and you know you just saw Batman Begins or whatever, mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, I want to learn more about Batman, and you go and you Google Batman and you're like, okay, here's a list of, you know, like the five most recommended graphic novels that, you know, like this person is saying that I should read if I want to start reading Batman, and that mm-hmm. list of graphic novels is going to be like The Killing Joke, The yep. Dark Knight Returns,
yep.
Year One. None of those stories are gonna do anything for like a 14-year-old girl. Like, it just doesn't do it. Like, these yeah. that is not how you make a Batman fan.
Yeah, they're not very kind to women either.
No, exactly. Like, and like, you know, like they have historical like importance and whatever, and like I'm not saying that like teen girls should not read those books, because whatever, if that's what your thing is, that's what your thing is. But like, if you're trying to make a new Batman fan out of someone who isn't already kind of like ingrained in like nerd culture or whatever, you know, like who isn't already kind of like predisposed to it, then like you have to do it by getting them interested in the characters. You have to do it by getting them interested in the relationships. Like, that's how, like, so if you want to make a teen girl a Batman fan, hand her like Bruce Wayne Fugitive, or hand her like Under the Hood, or something that's like about Bruce's relationship to his adopted sons, like something that's about his relationship with, you know, like the Robins relating to one another, about, yeah. you know, like Oracle and Nightwing, or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. that's how you do it. And I think that's it's obvious, like in such a way that it's, you know, there are people who want to get more out of pop culture. Like, there are people who have not been represented, who have not been, you know, spoken to in pop culture at all. And shipping is really sort of the antidote for that. It's finding that subtext, like you were just talking about. It's finding ways to kind of talk back to the narratives that are being presented, mm-hmm. And reconfigure the puzzle pieces. It's looking at comics and pop culture just in general as living documents, as like living things that can have, that you can have a conversation with, that mm-hmm. aren't just like set in stone, that like, oh, okay, like this is fine, like this is exactly what it is, and that's, you know, all it's ever going to be. Because there is that need, there's always going to be that need to say like, well, I like the idea here and I really like the characters, but I wish I didn't feel so weird about it, or like I wish I didn't feel like I had to kind of like look away at certain points, you know, like there's that, you know, like that need when you're not the intended audience for a thing, there's that need to move the pieces. Like it just, it's part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what shipping should be. And that's what shipping should always be. And I hope, you know, like I love shipping and I love the idea that, you know, like any text at all is subject to whoever's looking at it. Like it should be a magic eye puzzle. Yeah. Like it should always be something that you can look at and find whatever you want, however you want. However, I wish that it wasn't always a matter of, you know, like the, you know, like the young queer kids or like the young, you know, like the kids who aren't the intended audience of, and the intended audience is always the same, right? Like it's always, especially in comics, it's always the same people who are the intended audience. I wish that, you know, like it would become a magic eye puzzle for everyone. Right. And so like, I think that that's kind of where the big conflicts about shipping and whatnot are coming in, because you have a lot of young kids who are, you know, like really active on social media, who are extremely well-intentioned, who have kind of got this lexicon of like the arguments that they can use, to, you know, like explain why their ship is important, why it should be canon, why being canon is important. And they do it in such a way that it becomes, you know, harassment or, you know, like really violent hate campaigns, which, I mean, obviously I'm never going to defend, you know, these sort of like big giant, you know, crisis campaigns that happen, right. You know, in fandoms and in shipping and people, you know, trying to tear each other apart because they think that their ship is, you know, more important for X, Y, or Z reason. But those are kind of the things that everyone always points to say that like, oh, well, shipping is bad because teen girls are loud and mean and they, you know, bully people off the internet, which is true. That does happen. Like, I'm not going to discount that. And I'm not going to say that that doesn't matter. However, I think that that's just become a really convenient excuse to kind of look past why shipping has become such a thing and where that anger is coming from. Because I mean, they're, you know, like you can't expect 17-year-old girls and, you know, 17-year-old queer kids on Tumblr who have, you know, probably just started dipping their toes into like activism to really understand how to wield that power and to do it responsibly. Which is, you know, like you can't, I don't know. It's one of those very complicated things that like, I, you know, like I'm never going to wish that like people just kind of turn a blind eye to the bad behavior of shipping fandoms. And I'm never going to say that it's, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, like, oh, we should just ignore it until it goes away. However, I think that there's a lot of context that needs to be given whenever, you know, these big like news posts go up about like, oh, you know, like the Voltron fandom is at it again. Like, clearly it was such a stupid idea to like ever make any of these characters queer in the first place. And clearly they just weren't doing it right. And clearly like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, those are the wrong conversations to have about shipping. And I think that, you know, like, I think if anyone, if especially with like these, you know, kind of old guys who are just kind of like, oh, well, that settles it. Shipping is bad. Like, you know, like you need to kind of step back and say like, wait a minute, where is this coming from? Why is it so important to these people? Like, how do we kind of harness this energy and refocus it in a positive way that doesn't involve, you know, bullying people or, you know, giant harassment campaigns and blah, blah, blah. Right. Like, there are ways to do it. And it's a shame that it's kind of become, it's still, I guess, a dirty word, or it's still kind of this disparaged thing.
Right. And I think that, you know, a lot of obviously, yeah, I agree with you in the sense of, especially now in this age of Comicsgate and Gamergate and all this other stuff, like wanton harassment and you know, death threats and all kinds of the crazy escalation that things could get to is never acceptable, never anything that you want to promote. But I feel like in the case of a lot of these kids that you're talking about specifically, again, it's a reaction to not being seen and feeling like they're not seen and not having a voice. And you know, the internet is one of these things that we as a species are going to have to figure out in terms of the balance between, you know, unlimited access in a sense to random strangers, where we can just go on to social media and interact with people who, and you know, and again, in some senses, some people are open and they want that fan interaction and they want to have, you know, these back and forth. But again, you know, like with what we've seen with Star Wars and a lot of other stuff, you know, I mean, like people don't want to be threatened in any way or shape or form for just existing. But you know, sometimes I see, just in general, this was shipping, but also just general internet outrage, is that you know, what is happening on the tamer levels, not the I'm gonna like murder you, but like you know, I don't like X, I don't like what's happening levels, is that there's obviously just there's a miscommunication, but there's also this sense of, again, people who have been shut out for so long who now have a voice. You know, sometimes there's that tendency to step over the line only because, like, you know, when you've been told to wait for so long.
Yes.
And now you're kind of like, I don't want to wait anymore. But also, like, you know, like, I can't, like, everybody has been telling me that. So instead of me just assuming that you're going to listen to me, like, I'm just going to scream first.
Right.
Hope that the aftermath of that. So, you know, there's got to be understanding on both sides from people who, you know, if you're getting that kind of that level of passion from fans who are saying these things, maybe take a second to stop and consider why they're so passionate and you know, not even like, you know, well, I'm just going to give in and like give them what they want, but figure out ways that you can do that. Because for me, a lot of the stuff, again, even something like Stucky, you know, Marvel does tons of what if stories.
Right.
Marvel has tons of alternate universes.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why that can't exist in some way, shape, or form. That's, I mean, for a diehard Marvel fan to be like, that's ridiculous, they would never. It's like, well, like, how many alternate timelines are there? Like, how many? Yeah. Like, why? Like, why not?
It's one of those things. Like, the other big important piece of the puzzle when it comes to shipping and kind of understanding shipping is like the fact that it, for teens, and this is me speaking 100% from experience, and like, luckily I was a teen before kind of the biggest part of the social media boom. Like, I was a teen when like LiveJournal was a big thing, so like, which is a totally different experience than like what it is now, which, like, thank God, I don't know what I would do if I could go back and find like a bunch of things from when I was a teen, still just preserved in amber on the internet. But the idea, like, shipping becomes as volatile as it is because when you're, you know, like a 13, 14, 15 years old, and you're just, and if you're a person who has felt ignored and felt like you don't really belong in, like, which is kind of the universal teen experience, right? But like, if you're a kid who has that experience and you're, you know, skewed towards fiction and you're skewed towards kind of pop culture, shipping can be one of the first, if not the first way for some of these kids to find a community for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes very, very important. It becomes very foundational to like the identity of that person, because suddenly like all of your friends that you've made because you have the same ship, and all of, you know, like the people in your life that are, you know, like in any way, shape or form like you, or something that you like, someone that you can identify with, are because of a ship. And so it becomes way more than just like, oh, I really want to see these two characters kiss on my favorite TV show.
Right.
Or like, oh, I really want to see these, you know, like these two characters should, you know, marry each other in this comic or whatever. It becomes so much more than that, and so much more layered, you know, in ways that are both very extremely healthy and extremely important and extremely unhealthy, which, I mean, the unhealthy part is, it's just something you kind of got to work through, I think. Right. Like, especially when you're a teen, like, everyone's going to kind of, you know, go through that and come out the other side, hopefully, and be like, whew, okay, I'm glad that's over. But like, you know, like when you're in it, it's a totally different thing. And so when, especially with these, you know, 13, 14 year old kids who now have access to talk about it publicly and loudly and, mm-hmm. and kind of move forward, it becomes, you know, like you, people who are dealing with that have to have that sort of inherent understanding of like, just because these kids are, you know, like screaming about wanting, you know, like a ship or wanting, you know, like whatever, that might be, and that's probably exactly what they want even in their own minds. But like, you know, 5-10 years down the line, they're going to look back and be like, oh, like it wasn't actually about the fact that like I wanted these two characters to get married or I wanted these two characters to date or whatever. Like this was a way more complicated, way more personally, way more like internalized thing that like was super important to me. And I think that's a huge challenge, and there's no right or wrong way to like handle that. And there's no right or wrong way to like, you know, for anyone on either side to kind of deal with how that, you know, shakes out. But that's one of the, like, if only we could stomp, I guess, and that's not true. There is one important way that we should, you know, kind of start handling this. And that's people, especially like professionals in the universe, like in the, like whatever universe that they're in, need to stop scoffing at the idea of shipping. And they need to stop being like, oh, well, it's just, you know, stupid kids, right. Whatever. Like, understand that it's just, this is so important to so many people.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the idea that like it is dismissed so outright, even like dismissed in like passive ways, like, I've had this conversation kind of before, and like the idea, like the word fan fiction being a pejorative for so many people. And it's like, it's not a thing. Like fan fiction in its like most basic term covers like every superhero comic ever written. Like it covers like the entire Star Wars expanded universe. Like that's all fan fiction. Like that is what that in like in its rawest, you know, like most basic, most reductive definition, like that's what it is. But for some reason, like when you think like, oh, expanded universe, like that's like high concept and beautiful. But when you think fan fiction, it's like, oh, that's trash.
Yeah. And that's again, there's the understanding that if you're a creator, you can't be reading people's fan fiction. Obviously, you don't want to do that. But at the same time, as a creator, I would be, if I created something and a whole bunch of people were so passionate about it that they wanted to tell their own stories.
Right.
That's kind of a positive thing. Obviously, you're so passionate that they're showing up at your house and all kinds of other stuff. That's a different.
Right. That's a totally different thing.
But, and you know, if they're coming up to you at conventions and saying, you know, I love these characters, and, you know, they're telling you not their stories, but just how, you know, how much they mean to them and stuff like that. That means that you're doing something right, because people are obviously connecting with these characters and their relationships.
Yeah. And like, it happens, like the language is so important too. Like I've like with fan fiction, not being a pejorative, like the idea that like when someone says like on Twitter or on Tumblr or whatever, when someone gives like a list of headcanons, it's like immediately just like eye rolled, like, oh, whatever, this is fangirl bullshit. Right. But when, you know, like, if, like, a website, like, I've done this before, like, if you write, like, for, like, a website, like, something that I wrote for, like, IGN or whatever, like, here's a list of, like, really cool fan theories, which are just headcanons. Like, that's all it is. Like, that's literally all it is. But, like, there's a huge amount of legitimacy there because it's a fan theory, and that's inherently, like, not a feminine, not, a, like, you know, not, like, a queer-coded, not an outsider terminology. Then it's like a big, you know, like, oh, it's like, oh, it's fan theories. We love fan theories.
Right.
But yeah, it's just like, that's, I think that if we're ever going to start taking shipping seriously, and if we're ever going to start, you know, kind of bridging the gaps that happen between, you know, fans who like shipping and like fan culture and fans who don't, the language is what's got to start moving first. Like the idea that like fan fiction is not a bad word. Headcanon's not a bad word. Fangirl culture is not a bad word. Like, that's all fine. Like, it can all just be a thing.
Well, I say we start taking shipping seriously here and start doing a little bit ourselves.
Yeah.
I'm going to open it up. So it can be any
sure.
P people in comics that you would like to put together? Is there any, whether it's Marvel, DC, or independent stuff, is there any couples that you can kind of think of that you would like to see together?
Oh boy. So right off the bat, I always, my like go-to crossover fan couple is always going to be Jason Todd and Bucky Barnes.
Okay.
And that is because prior to the MCU, prior to me like coming over to like the sucky side of things, blah blah blah, like I had a ship for all of the Robins but Jason, and I had a ship for all of the Cap characters but Bucky.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute, these two are perfect together, because like they both are basically the same character in different sides of the thing. So I had this whole, I think I actually found a fic for them, like way back in the day on like LiveJournal, and it was, you know, probably like a 600 word like nothing, just like the two of them meeting, and I was like, this is it, this is the one. So Jason and Bucky are one of my like big crossover OTPs. I also really I don't know necessarily know if this is like a romantic one or not, but like I deeply love the idea of Steve Rogers and Diana of Wonder Woman.
Okay.
That's so sweet. It's just so cute. I don't like, I'm so boring. Other than that, I'm trying to think of like,
I would say, I mean, I was thinking for Wonder Woman, I was not Captain America, but just America Chavez.
Ooh, yes. Yes.
They would work together.
Yes. And, oh my God, that would be so cute.
Yeah, and I could definitely see them fighting monsters together.
Yes.
Doing a lot of crazy stuff together.
Yeah, that would be very good.
Yeah, I think America would like Amazonia, Themyscira.
Oh, yes.
Would fit right in.
Yeah, I think America would be, I think that would be so much fun too, because like America's got such like a hard edge to her, and Diana's got like that sweetness that like they would balance each other out really well.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very good.
What else was I thinking? Yeah, I was thinking Thor and Power Girl.
Yes. definitely very, very cute.
And they would also enjoy punching things together.
Yes. oh my gosh, yes.
A lot of people like Harley Quinn and Deadpool.
Ugh. Yeah.
I'm kind of like, I don't know how that would work.
Can I hit you with this one?
Okay.
Harley and Gwenpool.
Ooh.
I'm not a big Wade Wilson fan. It's like he's fine, like whatever. Yeah. But like I think Harley and Gwen, like Gwenpool Gwen, would be extremely cute. And they both have kind of the same sense of humor.
Yeah.
Which would work really well. I'm trying to think of who I would put. God. Okay. this is a little bit off kilter.
Sure.
But I think it would be really good. T'Challa and Clark Kent.
I mean, I could see it.
Yeah.
I could definitely envision it.
It's hard. Like, I always want to, like, whenever I try to ship any, like T'Challa or, like, Namor, which T'Challa and Namor is, like, the best ship in the whole world.
Sure.
Just across the board. But I always try to, like, it's hard for me to ship T'Challa with anybody because I feel like he immediately outclasses them. <It's> like, but I feel like Clark is, like, in the DC universe, Clark is, like, the only person who wouldn't be bothered by that.
Yeah.
Like, he'd be like, oh, it's fine. Like, it's cool, whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, Aquaman and T'Challa, I guess.
Yeah.
On equal footing.
Yeah.
But yeah,
there's, but I feel like Arthur has a chip on his shoulder. Arthur wouldn't like to be outclassed. He wouldn't like to be like weird. Whereas like Clark is like, it's fine. Like he doesn't have the ego, whereas like Arthur does most of the time. Sometimes.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, so there's a few people that like I want to find somebody for, but I'm just like, so obviously like Constantine like just kills whoever
in
a relationship with him. Because I was like, Constantine and Elsa Bloodstone could work, but then like, I don't want Elsa to die.
Constantine and Matt Murdock, they cancel each other out.
I think that's their
bad luck, just like it doubles down, and they end up just being really happy together, and nothing bad ever happens.
All right, we solved that one. Because I was like, Elsa Bloodstone and Batwoman
would be
good together. They could both hunt monsters together.
Yes.
I want to find somebody for She-Hulk, but I'm also like, I don't know who would work. I mean, again, unless it was somebody like Power Girl.
Right. Yeah, I could see. I don't know. She-Hulk's hard. Like, that's a really difficult one.
There's a lot of, like, again, I would say She-Hulk and Booster Gold.
Sure, why not?
Because they both just want to have fun, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Have a good time, and, you know, I mean, She-Hulk is definitely more of the adult relationship. And then Blue Beetle and Ted Kord, I mean, Blue Beetle and Hellcat.
Yes.
Could go together, and then they could do a double date. So then it all...
Yes.
It all works out.
Sure, I think I think it would be... God, I feel putting Ted Kord with like anybody who isn't Booster in my head is just like not compute. Like, I just
But that's why it's a double.
Like a big poly tangle that's happening. Yeah. I just, like, Ted has the same thing. Like, Ted is like the anti T'Challa to me, whereas just like anybody who's like with Ted like has to be able to like bolster Ted's self-esteem, because it's just like, Ted is kind of a downer. Like, not necessarily a downer, but like, he's kind of Charlie Brown, right? Like,
yeah,
he's a little bit always like, oh no.
But then again, then it's one of those things where you like, it's a package deal. Like, you're getting Booster too. Like, you love Ted,
right?
You know what I mean? If you can't get along with Booster, like, it's, I think, I don't know if Ted, like, I don't know if I want to put him in that situation where he had to choose, you know,
he was
in love with and Booster, but I feel like,
right.
And I guess, I don't think Booster would force him to do that.
No, I don't think so either. I think it would be very much like, if Ted and Booster were not dating each other, it would be very much like I forget their names. I didn't actually watch the show all that much, but like the two main characters on Scrubs.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like that sort of like, everybody just understands like,
mm-hmm.
Ted and Booster, like, you just can't be jealous. You can't be anything about it. Cause like, that's just always going to be like the baseline for those guys.
Yeah.
Ted and Booster is another like comic OTP that I feel very strongly about.
Is my favorite superhero.
Oh, really?
So, I'm always just like, no matter what, he's got Ted. You know,
yes.
When he didn't have Ted for that.
But, the saddest period of time ever.
It was. But now they're back together. I think there's got to be a way. I'm imagining within the world of Rebirth, you know, Ted is around somewhere. So
yeah,
well,
like,
he is.
Both Ted and Booster are around, but like, they have yet to really, I mean, that's not true. They did share. They shared a couple pages together in Mr. Miracle, which is kind of dubiously canonical anyway. So like, we're not 100% sure where that fits. But beyond that, they have not actually had a reunion. They have not had a reunion, an official, actual, genuine reunion since Ted died, unless you're talking about like Convergence or like, you know, like kind of out of the timeline stuff. So I'm really anxious and very nervous about.
It's gotta be coming. I hope so, have a good feeling.
I have a doomed feeling. Like, I feel like, because like Ted is, or Booster's featuring in Heroes in Crisis.
I know.
Which I'm stoked about. I can't even wait for Heroes in Crisis. However, it seems incredibly bleak and very, very sad.
But maybe that's it on the other side. You know, they find each other again, if they haven't already. And it's, they're all back.
That's my hope. It would be the best.
All right. Well, yeah. Is there any more that you can think of that kind of get you?
I wish I were better at this, but no. That's I'm like, all right. For as much as I love shipping and like as much as I have fun like talking about it, I'm always like, whenever anyone asks me to like come up with like weird ship stuff, I'm like, well, yeah.
Well, I'm sure everybody listening at home has already gone through their heads and made all the matches. So,
oh yeah, probably way better than I have, like way better.
Well, before I let you go, tell everybody where they can find you, because obviously you write for a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. Obviously for DC, mm-hmm. you do the relationship roundup, which I enjoy a lot. Talking about all the different relationships in the DC universe, so people mm-hmm. who are getting into it can kind of know the history and all the stuff behind it. So yeah, let us know what you're working on, what you're doing, where we can find you on the internet.
You can find me predominantly on Twitter, which is my handle is Rusty Polished. That's RUSTY and then polished, like past tense polished. And then beyond that, I have a bunch of regular columns, on DC's website, DCComics.com. I'm also doing a bunch of editorial stuff for the upcoming brand new DC Universe app, which I think is launching officially on Batman Day, which is September 15th. Mm-hmm. So definitely check that out. I can't answer any questions or anything, mostly not because I'm a jerk about it, but because I literally don't know. Like I'm a freelancer, so I get freelancer level information, mm-hmm. Which is basically like, write this. Okay, great. Thanks. Bye. So, I mean, definitely check that out. I'm also pretty regularly on GameSpot, GameSpot Universe, which is their entertainment wing. So I do a bunch of like explainers for them. So if you've ever been needing to like, oh, like Mr. Nobody just got announced for the Doom Patrol villain. Like, who the hell is that? Like, mm-hmm. that's where you can find me talking about that sort of thing. And then beyond that, yeah, just... I'm not good at Instagram. I'm not good at Tumblr or anything like that, but Twitter's the best one. Rusty polished.
All right. We'll definitely check out all that stuff that Meg has coming up. And thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
And I'll definitely, I feel like I have to have you back on because there's a lot of other stuff that we can
talk about. I can go on for days.
Yeah. Well, that's going to do us for us here on Stark After Dark. So thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Thanks again to Meg for being my guest this week on the show. Next week, my guest will be author and illustrator Ezra Clayton Daniels. He's the 2017 Dwayne McDuffie Award winner for diversity in comics for his new graphic novel, Upgrade Soul, which is out now from Lion Forge Comics. It's a fascinating look at relationships and love and identity. So we're going to talk all about that. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach out at starkafterdarkpodcast@gmail.com with any questions, concerns, ideas, etc. You can also reach out at jrsosa18 on Twitter. Love to talk to you there. And if you want to help us out, you can always like, subscribe to the podcast, all that good stuff. But that's it for me this week. I'll see you next week.